Karen Miriam Goldberg is the author of numerous books and a frequent guest on KPR Presents. Her latest novel is Miriam's Well, A Modern Day Exodus. It is always great to see you, Karen.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be here, Kay. Thanks for all you do with this amazing show.
Before we talk about your Miriam, let's go back thousands of years to the story of Miriam, the older sister of Moses. Many of us know that she was instrumental in helping hide Moses in the bulrushes and helping save him, but many may be unfamiliar with the story of Miriam's well.
Absolutely. And we know that Miriam, when it was decreed that all Jewish boys would be killed, put her little baby brother in a basket and sailed him down to his next home, and she may have kept her eyes on him for many years to come. And I believe she was very involved in just the grassroots organizing of the Exodus. But in the Old Testament, she's referred to several times. One is with Miriam's well. It's said that wherever the wandering Jews landed in their 40 years looking for a home, she did some type of cosmic magic trick with a stone and made a well appear. And once a well was there, people could water their animals, grow crops, so it literally fed them. The other thing she's known for in a Hebrew prayer called the Mikamoka is leading the women singing and dancing through the desert for 40 years. So it's no surprise that my fictional Miriam cooks, bakes, and she can sing like nobody's business.
Okay. Let's jump ahead to 1965. Your Miriam, the protagonist of Miriam's Well, her story opens in Brooklyn of 1965. Give us a quick overview of her story.
Miriam was born and grew up in a small section of Brooklyn called Flatbush, very much a neighborhood, and so many cities, especially some more than others, are just collections of neighborhoods. And she grew up in a Jewish family, but her father was African American and her mother was white. Her mother was also, and we learn this very early in the novel, really afraid to leave her home very much.
We'd probably call her agoraphobic now.
We certainly would. And Miriam has a younger brother, Aaron, and very soon into the novel, her mother is pregnant, and we can guess what that baby is named.
Her story will take her all across the United States. All across the world. And Miriam's Well, in a way, reminded me a little bit of Forrest Gump. In a way, the main character happens to be at crucial places at key points in American history. She's in New York City during the blackout of 1965, in Berkeley during the 1960s, New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, New York City on September 11th, 2001. Talk to me about her journey and sort of what you were trying to encompass as you had her travel around the United States.
I describe this book sometimes as Forrest Gump meets the Red Tent. Miriam just happens to be every place, or not every place, but many places where something really major historic is happening, whether a terrible tragedy such as the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, or even some little whimsical historical note such as the Keys seceding from Florida in a whimsical way in the 1980s. Of course, 5 minutes later, they applied for foreign aid. So she keeps showing up at these places, but it's not like she's aiming herself specifically for these places. Her motivation throughout the book is to follow her very strong purpose. She knows she's supposed to go someplace. Often she doesn't know why, or she knows she's supposed to leave a place. She knows that her role in life is to help people and to just drop everything and really be there in any way that she can. But she's also very much a wanderer. She's looking for home. She struggles a lot with not having a clear sense of her people and of her place. All that said, I did have all kinds of outrageously bad drawings of maps with lines and charts and all kinds of ways to try to keep track of where she might end up when. And I also made it my business to have her go places where if I hadn't been, I would just have to make a special trip while I was drafting the book to get a deeper sense of, so that I could write about each place with greater authenticity.
So you did some research on the road for this book.
I certainly did. And I also read a big pile of books about historic events, key testimonies, oral histories of everything from the Oklahoma City bombing to people who witnessed the Whittier Narrows earthquake in L.A. and other places where she's been.
Like the biblical Miriam, your Miriam and Miriam's Well, they share the gift of prophecy. In fact, the biblical Miriam has been often called the first woman prophet.
Absolutely.
What does your Miriam do with that gift? And I'm putting gift in air quotes because it seems like she's not really sure what she's supposed to do with it.
She definitely struggles. And at one point, she's talking to an older Lakota woman who also has the same gift. And she says, this is a curse to have a glimpse of what's going to happen, or just have a sense something awful's going to happen without knowing what. And the woman she's talking to says, never a curse, always a gift, always a blessing. But it's very difficult to know what to do with it. And I think for anybody who has those channels open in them in this culture, it's painful, difficult, awkward at best, sometimes excruciating at worst. I mean, to have nightmares that eventually make sense as giving you some glimpse that 9/11's going to happen is something extremely hard to live with. And so for Miriam, a lot of times what comes to her plays out more in what seems like her instinct. She knows she has to be a certain place, or she hears about something that has happened somewhere and off she goes. There's also times she tries to get away from any possibility of putting herself in close proximity to very difficult historic events or natural disasters because it's too painful. But ultimately, she's led to where she can be of service. From a very young age, she has such a strong drive to help people in ways that don't always make sense to people around her. And readers will quickly find out how she played hooky to work in a soup kitchen making outrageously delicious soups and belting out Motown songs for the people who came through.
As you just mentioned, there's a lot of tension in this book between her desire to seek adventure and her trying to find a home. And there's a quote in this book that I love, that she had left place after place with the ease of the next adventure's thrill calling her. Mm-hmm. And yet, there's this sense of where do I belong, and where are my people?
Absolutely. And leaving places with such an ease as she does in her 20s and 30s gets much harder when she gets to be in her 40s and 50s. And she does eventually sort of kind of settle someplace. And what she also finds is a strong sense of who her people are. And as readers move through the book, they'll see how that comes together. At one point, somebody toward the end of the book tells her that she has made her own people. She has coalesced around her a very intergenerational, multi-ethnic, very diverse group of people. Part of the tension that she experiences also plays out in one of my favorite relationships in the book, and that's between her and her brother, Aaron. Aaron is a brilliant boy genius, and let's just say he makes it very quickly and at a very young age in the corporate world and is doing very well and is living the American dream. And it drives him crazy in a thousand different ways that he can't get his sister to come back and settle down. And so by the end of the book, they come to understand each other much better. But I love how that relationship unfolds as a place where both of them are also working with each other to seek some kind of healing from some family traumas that happen early in the novel.
And as much as he doesn't understand her journey, she doesn't really understand his motivations and sort of what keeps him grounded in corporate America.
It's very hard for her to understand. And some of the places she lives are really beyond what we hardly ever see in the mainstream. I mean, she lives in an eco-village, you know, at one point. She lives in Key West, right on the edge of the country. She eventually lives in an island off the coast of Maine. She lives in so many places where the common joke is, okay, I'm going to leave this place and go to America and I'll be right back. Even though these are places in America, and some right in the middle, such as extreme West Texas, which has its own sense of being that's very different from what we might see when we look at the news or magazines, she continually finds herself drawn to places where it's kind of difficult to reconcile what the essence of that place and the communities there have to do with some of the bigger and more mainstream views of America. And in many ways, because this is a book about history, and because this is a book about mythology, and the big stories we tell ourselves about who we are and how we are to live, and what it means to be alive, and what it means to be part of a community, where Miriam goes shows us many different myths in America, many different big overstories that unfold for us a variety of visions of how people can make a life of meaning.
Miriam's journey brings her to Kansas, but only briefly to Lawrence, where she says the rents are too high and the wind is too strong. Now, you've lived in Lawrence for 35 years. Why set so little of her story in the place that you call home?
Well, that was hard for me. I really wanted her to live in Kansas and especially Lawrence, which to me is the center of the universe. You know, I always joke that the first rule of living in Lawrence is don't leave. And the second rule is if you leave, you have to come back. But this just isn't who she is. And as I followed the character and where the character was kind of tugging me toward, I just saw that for a variety of reasons that probably neither she nor I can even articulate, it just wasn't her place. But she does have a connection in Western Kansas, which people will find out about, and that also opens her eyes in some new ways. And we can tell readers, she kind of ends up in the middle of the country somewhere.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's no small coincidence that you and your protagonist share a name, hers mm-hmm. being her first name and your name being Karen Miriam Goldberg. This is a work of fiction, but what's the relationship between you and Miriam of Miriam's Well?
Well, my Hebrew name is Miriam, and I went through a time in my early 20s when I was kind of more distant with my father for various reasons that I stopped using Goldberg, and I went by Karen Miriam. And then I realized, by the time I got into my mid-20s, what a lot of us realize, you can't run away from who you are. So I hyphenated my own name, which made it very confusing, and by the time I got married, I just wasn't going to add another name. But I always was very grateful that my Hebrew name was Miriam. And even though I was named after a great-grandfather I never met, who seemed to be a bit of a despicable character, his name began with the letter M, so I was named Miriam as per the Jewish tradition, I felt a great resonance with her, that she kept the women singing and dancing, that she helped people find spirit. In Hebrew, what we call ruach, R-U-A-H, you know, this sense of being alive, of the joy and vitality of being here right now, and to make art out of it. So I figured it's a great Hebrew name for a writer or anybody who makes art. It's something to aspire to. And at the same time, Miriam is really different from me. I'm somebody who's pretty darn territorial. I love my community. I love my house. You know, it's difficult for me to not sleep in my own bed. I have to be where I am, and I'm extremely tied to community and to my people. And I'm very blessed to have been able to have my people, my place, and my purpose all together. But many of us struggle in one or more of those areas. And she's somebody who, because of how her life started out, maybe because of her life path or karma, maybe because of certain things that happened to her and her family and her history and ancestry, or a million other factors, has extremely different life lessons than me. I also can't really sing all that well. And while I can cook, I'm terrible at baking because I don't like to follow directions. So she's a, like I said, she's a different character. And I will say that a lot of my writing, my first novel, The Divorce Girl included, is very autobiographical. But this novel, not so much. But I can reveal that there's one character who I modeled after a beloved Lawrence friend of mine who died years ago. There's a character named Ben, who is a gay activist she meets in L.A., and he is modeled right after Ben Zimmerman, who was a good friend of mine and of some of ours, and helped get the first gay rights ordinance on the books in Lawrence and in Kansas. And it's an honor to kind of pass on his memory a little bit that way.
Karen, are you concerned at all that in reading this that people will assume that it's much more autobiographical than it really is, and that you are the Miriam in Miriam's Well?
I'm not really concerned about that. I'm more concerned when I do have autobiographical work out there. I'll say, if anybody's wondering, hey, read my other books, then you'll have a better sense of, oh, Miriam is really different than Karen. And, you know, what is autobiographical is a connection to place and a sense of the holy or the sacred being available to us, you know, in the big, vast sky, and our connection to the earth and our connection to community.
Food plays a huge role in this book. And again, to quote Miriam's Well, Miriam finds that cooking is the only thing that keeps her troubled mind calm. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the role of food in her life in this book. And is that something you share with Miriam?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I wake up in the morning and think, okay, what do I get to eat today? And, you know, it's kind of an old Jewish joke that almost every Jewish holiday can be reduced to three sentences. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. So Miriam is somebody who takes to the kitchen very early. Her mother is a really amazing cook and baker. And she's just drawn to cooking and baking. And the more she does it, the more it becomes a meditative practice for her. And as the book goes on, she teams up with other people cooking and baking in various ways. I love her relationship with a woman who becomes her sister-in-law, who's an amazing baker, and what they do together in a kitchen. And I have a great scene, and I think it's a great scene in one chapter, where they're able to order anything they want to outfit a kitchen from catalogs, and they both just can't stop giggling because they love making food so much. There's definitely scenes where characters cry because the food is so beautiful or so good. And there's also recipes that start to evolve. And about a month before we went to press, I could not stop waking up with the same thought that the book should include recipes. So I embarked upon a mad scramble, and we have 40 pages of recipes, including some from Lawrencians who've also written books like Nancy O'Connor, Janie and Frank Carey, Meg Hereford from the Lady Bird Diner. Hey, there's a recipe for her pies in this book. And Janet Major and other people who donated recipes. And the recipes all correlate to specific scenes and characters and have greater meanings because, as we all know, you know, food is more than just food. Food is something that is almost like a vessel that passes on our traditions, our stories, our ways of making community together, breaking bread, coming home to ourselves. So this is a book that definitely investigates that quite a bit.
You know, it's interesting the way you talk about the coming to the recipes almost after the fact. That's exactly the opposite of how I envisioned you wrote this book. I had this vision of you sort of thinking about food and the story you could weave from one latke to pie to, you know, the bruschetta. I had this vision that you outlined the story and worked it around the food.
Well, it must have been subconscious, but I also got to throw in recipes I created. Ode to a Grecian burrito is something I made up many years ago, and, you know, just certain things here and there. And I have to say that as I found recipes to put in the back, I then had to revise some things in some chapters to help introduce those recipes, but food was flowing all the way through.
So any of those recipes from your childhood?
Yes, there's, kasha vanishka, which might not make sense when I describe it, but definitely was in my childhood and lots of Jewish kids' childhoods. It's bow tie noodles and kasha grains, and it's just delicious. And there's also stuffed cabbage. And that recipe came directly from my sister, Lauren Pacheco, who created that recipe to replicate what our maternal grandmother, Molly Prusak, used to make for us. Like, stuffed cabbage was one of our favorites. And our grandmother from Poland, you know, was quite obliging.
Hmm. Karen, can I get you to read something from Miriam's Well?
Sure. Let's see. There's a lot of possibilities, but I'm going to read one short scene. At one point when Miriam is in San Francisco, cooking, baking, and helping care for people living in a hospice, the hospice starts to run out of money, and they need to figure out something quick to do. And she's doing this hospice with a man who owns it, named Brother Tom, used to be known as Thomas the Beast in his wilder days. And they decide that they're going to do a giant arts parade as a way to raise money. And this was autobiographical because I organized an arts parade, 25 years ago as part of Harvest of the Arts. It was a lot of fun. It was so much work. I've never done it since, but it gave me a lot of ideas. So they did this arts parade leading up to a banquet, and here's the scene. 2 days later, Miriam was spreading sun-dried tomato spread on eggplant dip on toasted baguette slices. They could hear the music outside getting closer. The marching band that had come together surprisingly quickly, called Brother Tom's Brothers and Sisters of Mothers, with their trumpets, violins, flutes, drums, and even big pots to hit with spoons as they played one song, Louie Louie. Everyone in the kitchen stopped and raced outside to watch the approaching parade. Now they were moving toward the dinner, jugglers and mimes, Shakespearean actors performing Richard III, and a dance troupe of men who wore tight black leotards and black berets and called themselves the Existentialists as they marched in the shape of a question mark and called out, "Where are the children?" Some of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, that was a real group in San Francisco, tossed condoms to the crowd, and several members of a local opera company belted out Carmen a good distance away from a group of Zen Buddhist marching poets who took turns calling out phrases such as sun on leaf. Miriam was part of the flowing sum of various parts. Her daughter was being pushed in her stroller down the street by Brother Tom's cousin Jack at the back of the parade in front of two elephants lent to them by an exotic animal farm in Arizona. Miriam and all the other kitchen volunteers sang along, applauded, and even cried at the totality of it all, especially when they saw the nine muses, each a drag queen who did herself up in silken togas and floral garlands while riding in antique convertibles. All Miriam could think about was how perfect this moment was, even if it happened in a sea of pain. The last singers, a Gordon McRae impersonator riding bareback behind a drag queen, Shirley Jones, belted out, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." Miriam couldn't help but join in. The dinner was a success, and by the end, Brother Tom had enough money to carry the hospice another year. "Pinch butts, not pennies," became the slogan Miriam and Brother Tom tossed back and forth from then on. This is a very different scene. This is just a scene about driving, and it happens when Miriam is living in extreme West Texas and hears about the Oklahoma City bombing, and it's just one small moment. As somebody who's biracial, she continually encounters people who project onto her what they think she is. And she passes as white, but some people think she's Latino, and some people think otherwise. And here she was driving like a fiend, you know, hours and hours and hours. She just has to do it. Let's just say she's married at the time, and the person she's married to is not happy about this. And she's also in the middle of menopause. So, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, April 1995. Miriam's urgency, anger toward her husband, and heat-induced hot flashes filled the long drive with so much tension that by the time she stopped to fill the gas tank, her right shoulder was frozen. Yet she was amazed to see that in her fury she had driven over 340 miles at 90 miles an hour. She rushed into the quick shop, picked up a gallon of cold water, and started drinking it right away in the store. She remembered she hadn't refastened her bra before heading to the counter with the water and two large chocolate bars. She told herself a person needs to do whatever it takes in such circumstances, and she realized she also needed directions. The clerk, a young man from India, unfolded a map of Texas and Oklahoma. "It's about 300 miles from here, but drive a little slower once you get to America," he said, winking at her. It was a common joke that Texas was its own country. "How many hours?" She was thrilled to be in air conditioning. "I think you could do it in 3.5. You have someone there you want to see is okay?" She shook her head. "I just want to help." He reached over to the shelf and handed her a brand new map, looked at her face, then handed her a large bag of potato chips and a thick beef jerky. "Take it all, no money." "Thank you so much," Miriam said, starting to cry. "No problem, my sister. You from India, too?" She shook her head. "You could be my sister," he said, smiling into her face. She took his hand and squeezed it, then headed out with her treasures. So I shared that because it's just a little moment, like a little beat in the whole song of her driving somewhere and meeting somebody and making a friend out of a stranger.
Karen, in all the time I've known you, you've never had just one project going on at a time. And sure enough, you've got Miriam's Well, A Modern Day Exodus, which has just come out, but you also have another book. Tell me about what else you're up to.
Well, thank you. I have these two giant books, and it might look like I just wrote two books at once, but I've been writing Miriam's Well for 14 years. And the other big book is called Everyday Magic, Field Notes on the Mundane and the Miraculous. And I had this wonderful opportunity, thanks to Meadowlark Press. And I should say Miriam's Well is a product of Ice Cube Press. And I'm so grateful for these presses for supporting writers and really treating us well. But I had an opportunity with Meadowlark to publish the best of my blog. I've been keeping a blog for a long time, 11, 12 years.
And I remember when you started it.
Oh, good. Well, we go way back. And this is a nice big book. And I had about 900 and something blog entries, and I had to figure out kind of the top 250. And then Tracy Million Simmons, who was my publisher, did a fabulous job with illustrations and photos. And this covers, I can just read a few topics,
sure.
Everything from In Praise of Grace Paley, I Enjoy Being a Girl, Mourning My Tax Guy, The road to hell is paved with snow. Satan called. He wants his weather back. Dance like everyone's watching. Wichita lineman in Wichita. And living with a big naughty dog. So it kind of travels all over the place. And so here I am with these two wonderful books that I get to put out in the world.
I love that description of some of the topics. It sounds like really a roadmap of the past 12 years of your life.
It kind of is. And I had to balance out not sharing too much of one thing or another. I did find that I write about my pets and the weather somewhat excessively.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. But you know, what can I say? You write about what you know. You write about what's on hand. But I also write about literature, you know, Adrian Rich, music, if you can call a little tribute to Davy Jones, you know, music, growing up, what privilege blinds us to, falling in love, empty nesting 2.0. There's quite a bit in here about grief. And one of my favorite titles is Cali Coco, the Flying Cat, or Why You Shouldn't Put a Feral Cat in Your Bathroom. So some days I just kind of aim toward, what's happening and how does it lead me to write? Last night I was weeding my garden in the rain, and after a while I started envisioning the blog post I could write called Weeding in the Rain.
Can I get you to read something from Everyday Magic?
I would love to. So this is a little one called Karma, a Disgruntled Cat and the Bobtailed Squirrel. For years, a certain squirrel has tormented my cats, strutting his stuff in slow motion from the deck railing while both kitties watched from inside the house. The more agitated the cats, the more indulgent the squirrel. He even jumped to the window that separated them. The cats on the window and side windowsill, the squirrel on the outside, mocking them in his miniature parade of pride. If the windows are cat TV, the squirrel was a daily reality show designed to inflame cat desires and piss them off. As such, he had high ratings. The cats were glued to watching the squirrel, who caused them no end of aggravation. Karma takes many forms. Although we try to keep our cats indoors because of coyotes in the area, Sydney, Iowa Goldberg has a habit of getting out, thanks to Shay the dog graciously opening the door for himself and the cat. The other day when Sid slipped out on his illegal afternoon walkabout, I worried a coyote might eat him. Later, I was relieved when he raced to the door to come back in. The next morning, when it was time for the squirrel show to begin, a curious thing happened. The squirrel returned, but not his tail. Oddly enough, the cats weren't as interested in the squirrel channel, and they also seemed strangely at peace while Mr. Squirrel walked along the railing with a lot less confidence or balance. Well, I can't prove Sydney bit off the squirrel's tail. It sure seems like a good possibility. In the meantime, the bob-tailed squirrel is struggling with low ratings, but hopefully he's finding enough fallen birdseed and acorns to get by. And there's even a picture of the bob-tailed squirrel.
The missing tail.
The missing
tail. You'll never know. You have your suspicions.
I have my suspicions. You know, looking out the windows is one of the great pleasures of our lives. This morning I saw a pair of indigo buntings, a mourning dove, and a blue jay all at the feeder. And, you know, and also this woodpecker who kept interrupting them. And the cats and I just watch for long stretches of time. And it's just fascinating what's happening around us at any moment.
Karen, it is always such a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for coming into KPR today.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this and also for lifting up writers all over the region. We really appreciate you.
Thank you. Karen Miriam Goldberg is a former poet laureate of Kansas. She read from Everyday Magic, Field Notes on the Mundane and the Miraculous. And before that, Miriam's Well, A Modern Day Exodus. Earlier this hour, we heard about Free State, Free Spirits, Lawrence Counterculture of the 1960s and 1970s. That exhibit is now in its final week at the Watkins Museum in downtown Lawrence. Join us Friday night for a closing party. I'll be recording oral histories and your memories of the era. find out more at the Watkins Museum website or on their Facebook page. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.